in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is the Rain Report. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. Roy Neal, K6DUE, passed on August 15, 2003, as a result of complications following heart surgery. Roy was an NBC television science reporter for more than 3 decades. He was a familiar voice on the amateur radio newsline, formerly known as Westlink Radio. Roy played a pivotal role in launching amateur radio into space and keeping it there, as you'll hear this week as RAIN founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, concludes his interview with Roy, conducted in the fall of 2000.
Timing is everything. According to Roy Neal, ham radio's introduction to NASA's space program truly was a matter of timing.
In the beginning, amateur radio and the space program were literally thousands of miles apart. NASA, having been formed of a group of engineers, literally didn't want people looking over their shoulder unless they were able to approve what was being done. So NASA, in its wisdom, sat there and said, we don't need or want ham radio. And ham radio kept saying, well, we'd love to be part of the program. And this went on for years. Ham radio first came to the fore in some coverage of space back when Sputnik first flew. Because if you remember, that little beeping sound was coming down to the Earth, and ham radio operators were the best equipped to receive it. And so suddenly we became rather popular in letting people listen to Sputnik. But as time went on, amateur radio really didn't have a place. And then NASA's point of view was simply, we don't need you, we don't want you, you're nothing but a nuisance to us. Until the time came that we moved into the space shuttles. And early on in the shuttle program, there was a general by the name of Abramson, a very smart guy. He was a 3-star Air Force general. And Abe and I were doing an interview one day, a rather casual interview, and we had some time between takes. When you do television interviews, they move the camera from point to point to get a little more mileage out of a single camera. So while the camera was moving, I gave him my amateur radio pitch number 322, which kind of went, when are you guys going to give us a shot at letting us show you what we can do with ham radio? Aboard the space shuttle, we could provide entertainment. We could provide backup communication for emergencies. We could provide contact with families. We could even provide education by letting astronauts in space talk to kids in school. Abe, being a delightful guy, cocked an eyebrow and said, you know, I'm interested in that, fascinated. Why don't you have your people make a presentation, send it to me, I will approve it. Well, need I say, Hap, that when the man in charge of the shuttle program says, put it on my desk and I'll approve it, you know that you just opened the door. I was in Houston at the Johnson Space Center at the time, and I got together with a couple of very good amateur radio operators who were also executives on a public relations level with NASA, Doug Ward and Chuck Biggs by name. This would have been in 1982, as it turned into 1983, because we're referring now to the fact that we're getting ready for Owen Garriott to fly the first equipment aboard his flight, which was in 1983. But before that, we obviously had a lot of talking around NASA to do, and we required the help of all these people, and of the ARRL, and of AMSAT. Because that afternoon, Doug, Chuck, and I got on the phone, and I remember we talked to Dave Sumner back at the ARRL, and Dave was kind enough to relay our thoughts, and the first thing you know, we were in business. Over on the AMSAT side, there was Vern Ripertella. And Rippy and Sumner very rapidly went to work. And in no time at all, here we were meeting with the top executives of NASA and deciding how we could put ham radio on board. Biggest problem was we couldn't penetrate the hull of the spacecraft to put an antenna in place. So a guy, Dick Fenner by name, with an assist by Lou McFadden, who, by the way, today is the Phase 3D guru electronically, but at that time, they were working in Houston. And they dreamed up a system where we could stick an antenna quite literally in a window using Velcro to hold it in. And that then would allow us to get out. Not well, but well enough. So we went to work, and Owen Garriott flew, and it was a tremendous worldwide success. The electronic industry supported us. We made video tapes galore. And ham radio was aboard the space shuttles. Over the next few years, we pioneered slow scan techniques, which, by the way, the feeling among the engineers still lingered. When we had demonstrated slow scan TV with Tony England on the second flight carrying ham radio, we showed some very beautiful pictures of the crew, and we then sent pictures of the wives down below up to the crew, and it was great. Well, we went to the new head of the shuttle program at that time, who was probably better unnamed here, and said to him, "Sir, the robot people who built those slow scan television devices would like to equip NASA so that your spacecraft could carry color for the first time in terms of transmission of pictures from Earth to space, and they just want to give them to you." And he said, "Are you kidding? We'll design and develop something better than that. We'll do our own. Thank you very much. Thank them very much for me, but no thanks." And there again was the attitude. However, that attitude has changed over the years, and as 1996 rolled around, serious conversation was being devoted to what would be aboard the International Space Station, which would then be the successor to the various programs that we had seen. At that time, we, the SAREX group — SAREX, by the way, was an invented name that we came up with, meaning Space Amateur Radio Experiment. And that was the title under which we literally flew several dozen missions aboard space shuttles, put thousands of kids in contact with astronauts, and had ourselves a very viable means of communication which the astronauts loved. They could talk to their families privately, not through the NASA links. The school kids enjoyed it. They enjoyed talking to the kids in school. And it was a grand thing. Now, by the time 1996 rolled around, we realized that even space law wouldn't cover what was going to happen on an international space station. How do you handle people who speak different languages, work under different regulations for ham radio? So we got together in Houston. SAREX organized the meetings. AMSAT and ARRL supported it thoroughly. NASA also supported it thoroughly by this time. They were in camp with us. We then, in meeting, came up with the name ARIS, Amateur Radio International Space Station. And that's where ARIS came from. Now, the same nations that were a working part of that, and there were only eight or nine of them — there are quite a few more nations than that involved with space station, but the stations of the nations, rather, that we were involved with at that time are still very much in business. And the prime movers of the program are the United States, Russia, the Germans, who are very active in this field, the Canadians, who are tremendous supporters of our whole operation, the British to a minor degree, the Italians to a great degree. The Italians have even developed and built antennas at their own expense. Because as you move into space station, there will be a tremendous difference.
I'm speaking today with Roy Neal, KCDUE, former science editor of NBC Television, producer, reporter, and of course a familiar voice on Amateur Radio Newsline. We'll be right back. This is the RAIN Report.
Space station, among other things, will have external antennas. As a matter of fact, the ports are already in orbit. The antennas will be going up within about another 6 to 8 months. And by the time those antennas are in place, you're going to start hearing a tremendous difference in signal strength coming down from the small transceivers that we use. Our plans for space station are many and varied. They involve slow scan television, compressed regular TV, packet, of course, all kinds of voice communication, even some experimentation on lower bands, such as 10 meters. And that should be very interesting, too. When we're able to link with Phase 3D and other amateur satellites of advanced design, we'll be able to give the hams on the Earth longer periods of communication. Right now, that low Earth orbit of the space station will limit us to about 10 or 11 minutes a pass. But when they can link through something like Phase 3D, which will come in time in about 4 or 5 years, we have high hopes for being able to communicate for 45 or 50 minutes at a time, or even more. That will be the revelation, and that will be the future, when ham radio will really be kingpin of the space business from the standpoint of being recreational, utilitarian, and educational. Those are our objectives, and I put them in reverse order. Education is actually our number one priority, and experimentation would be number two, general QSOs with hams would be our number three priority. And, of course, in those general QSOs, somewhere in there looms large the fact that astronauts and cosmonauts will be able to talk with their families here on Earth.
And yet we still face some really major challenges, don't we?
I think the thing we face most as a service is that too many hams forget to be of service. Too many of them are concerned only with communicating with themselves, Hap. There are groups of amateurs who are tremendously concerned with maintaining service and who do so. But the great bulk of hams is not in it for that. I would like to see a great deal more in terms of service being done. Now, when we start talking about amateur radio, International Space Station, and communicating with schools, for example, we have what are called mentors provided by AMSAT. These are active AMSAT operators, darn good hams, who in turn go into the schools and teach the kids how to build the equipment so they can communicate with space. Now, that's carrying the thing along to a fine degree. It is indeed a potentially great tool, and our space work has been and continues to be a great tool for just that kind of work. But beyond that, I see in the future an entire change in amateur radio as we move into space to an ever-increasing degree. And I think when this happens, some of the old guard are going to have to relinquish their old guard stance and move up into more modern times, more modern equipment, more modern frequencies. They're afraid of it right now, Hap, I'm afraid. Because of that, we're losing on the opportunity to do a lot of things we might do. I'm surprised, for example, when our clubs, instead of talking ham radio, talk the best way to hunt the deer that are in the woods nearby, or whatever happens. Somehow they've lost track of the ham radio, which is what is their raison d'etre. And it concerns me quite a bit.
Well, we still have frequencies that we will need 5-10 years down the road, especially in the microwave region, to do the sort of things that you're talking about amateur radio doing from the space station.
We may very well lose the frequencies that we have right now in that whole general microwave region. And if we do, it will be for lack of interest on the part of the general ham population. Unfortunately, too many people are afraid of the systems. The technology is here right now. Just before we started this interview, I was looking at my NOVA program and tracking, of all things, the Soyuz as it was moving in on the space station, getting ready to put the first Expedition 1 crew on board. I'm able to track that on my PC at home right now. That same software could also set up my AZL antennas, my azimuth and elevation antennas, so that I could track the Soyuz, should I choose to, and the antennas would track it very nicely. We're moving beyond that, though, and what I was referring to is that I'd love to see hams get involved with simpler systems so that you don't have to resort to all that tracking. Simpler systems meaning, of course, ever higher orbits, going into either geosync or Molniya-type orbits, which allow us long times on stations without the need to trace them across the sky. We're getting mail from guys who say, well, gee, my 2-meter gear is 10 years old, and it won't do what it has to do to be able to track those satellites. Well, it never occurs to these people that if they'd use their ingenuity, they could use that same equipment that's there right now on their bench. But what they have to do is think their way through the problem, Hap, and I don't see much of this happening.
Well, Roy, we could go on forever and ever, but this has been a wonderful time for me and a learning experience, since I really didn't watch a whole lot of TV, especially television news in the 60s and 70s, having been born in 1951. It will be interesting to see what transpires in the next 5-10 years in amateur radio and in your field of news reporting as well.
It's been a great pleasure, Hap, and I do hope that both of us will live to see amateur radio and the news business both progress, move higher, better, faster, and I suspect we very well might.
If you'd like more information about the Amateur Radio International Space Station, you can go to its website, which is just a click away from our site's mention page at therainreport.com.
Hap Holly, KC9RP, interviewing the late Roy Neal, K6DUE, former science reporter for NBC Television, key player in launching and keeping amateur radio in space, and a longtime reporter for Amateur Radio Newsline. Roy was truly a class act and will be greatly missed. The Rain Report is copyright 2003, Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Blair Alper, KA9 SEQ.